The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
They want to impeach Trump. They want to censure Cruz. They want to expel other congressmen and senators. They want to silence us, deplatform us. What is the left's endgame? Sponsored by MyPillow.com, this is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Hi, I'm Dinesh D'Souza, and as we watch this, these eerie developments all around us, the intemperate rhetoric, the impeachment train rolling forward. I believe the articles of impeachment will be put on the floor tomorrow, Wednesday. As we see the digital deplatforming begin to widen its scope, people being constantly hounded and censured for what they believe and what they think and what they say, where is this really headed? Where is it all going? What's the left trying to accomplish here? Are they trying to accomplish the end of America? Well, how does that make any sense? Because it's their America, too. They're going to have to live in it. So if they knock the place down, it's going to be a bad place, presumably, for them to live in, right? It seems to me that one way to think about this is that what they want is not so much to end America, but to end American exceptionalism. Now, American exceptionalism is a scholar's term to describe what makes America different, what makes America unique. And I think if we look around and see a lot of the bad stuff going on around us, we can see that this bad stuff, although surprising to us, is not surprising to people around the world. The idea that if you have the wrong set of political beliefs, you can be beaten up for it, that happens elsewhere. In my home country of India, there are certain things you can't say about the government. Somebody will beat you up. So Indians look at this and they go, yeah, that's kind of, we recognize that. So American exceptionalism is that it doesn't happen here. And American exceptionalism is also why I came to this country. I grew up in a country, a socialist country. And the left today likes to say, well, you know, we don't support the old authoritarian types of socialism. We want democratic socialism. Well, India had democratic socialism. And I was only a kid as I experienced it. I experienced it in terms of material scarcity. My family had this ration card in which my mom could only buy so much rice and sugar and cooking oil. But I think the thing that struck me even more than that was that for me, socialism was embodied in corruption, corruption that was sort of endemic in Indian life. You couldn't do anything, certainly nothing with the government, without having to make a deal, pay someone under the table, or you had to know someone who knew someone who knew someone else. It was in this, that sense not a country based upon fair rules, certainly not equal rights or equal rules applying to everybody, no. And when I came to America, what struck me most was not just the abundance of American life, but was certain little things about America that made me go, huh. And I didn't know I was discovering American exceptionalism. My mom came to visit some years later, and she discovered it too. We were traveling down, I think it was Highway 1 in California, and she saw a sign on the highway that said, Adopt a Highway. My mom goes, what is that? And at that time, I was a little acclimated. I go, well, Mom, you know, it's Adopt a Highway. She goes, Adopt a Highway? Who adopts a highway? I mean, no one in India would think of adopting a highway. And I explained to her it was the Rotary Club or some civic group doing this. And I remember her scratching her head. She was really puzzled because, in a sense, she realized that it's only in America that people take this kind of civic responsibility. That's a small example of American exceptionalism. I think the left wants to end that. They don't like it. They've never liked it. To them, America is not exceptionally good. If there is American exceptionalism, America is exceptionally evil. America is exceptional because it has done the most to harm the world. It had one of the most extensive slave systems in the world. It exterminated the native Indians. It's spreading its pollution throughout the world in the form of neocolonialism and so on. So for the left, to end American exceptionalism is to end this empire, you might say, of exploitation and evil. And the left wants to create a different America, one that would be unrecognizable to many of us, and one that would dissolve many of the things that we like most about America. The opportunity for a guy like me, who came to America with $500 in my pocket, to not only make a better life for myself, but to also be the architect of my own destiny, to be in the driver's seat of my own life. I mean, look at what I've done with my life. I've been an author, I've been a think tank, a scholar, I've been a campus speaker, I've been a movie maker with a feature film, Infidel, out in the theater and now available for you to watch at home. I have lived the American dream. And no other country in that sense has this kind of a dream. I mean, the Indians, there's no Indian dream. There's no Chinese dream. The French may have a dream, but I don't really think we want to know what it is. And it will be very sad if this America goes down the tubes. Now, we like to think that we can save this America. And we still speak in some ways of a national unity that I think deep down we know is dissolving before our eyes. Take, for example, the national anthem. We talk about America's national anthem. It's our anthem. But is it really? Do we even have a national anthem anymore? When at major sports games, the national anthem, which was part of the ritual of the game, is now suspended, the players are taking a knee. A whole group of people in this country don't like the anthem. They don't want to sing it. We can't really make them. We talk about the American flag. It's our flag. Well, it is, but don't we really mean that today it is our flag, meaning it's the flag of conservatives, it's the flag of Republicans? If you drove by a home right before the election and you saw a big American flag, couldn't you make a reliable prediction of who that family was going to be voting for, or at least who the guy that put that flag out there is going to be voting for? The point I'm trying to make is it's become, in a sense, our flag. I'm not even sure it's their flag anymore, which is to say that even some of the basic sort of symbols of America, and these aren't just symbols in and of themselves, they stand for things. So even the things that the flag stood for, the idea that America should be strong, America should be prosperous, America should be an example to the world, the world would be a better place if it became more like America. All of this that goes with those ideas of American exceptionalism, those real things are being, I think, pulled down along with the symbols of America. And that leaves us with a little bit of a startling realization that if we're going to save American exceptionalism, we have to save it. How we do that is going to be one of the big subjects of this podcast, and especially how we do that in the face of opposition, in the face of political domination on the other side, in the face of a kind of monoculture, a alliance between tech companies and corporations and the media to go after us. Can we survive? Can we thrive? I believe we can, but we've got to keep our heads on straight. We've got to be creative, we've got to be tough, and we've got to do things a little differently than we have in the past. I'll be right back. I want to talk to you about MyPillow and how this has literally changed my life. These pillows are amazing. They won't go flat. You can wash them as often as you want, and they're made in the USA. Now, for a limited time, Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow, is offering his premium MyPillows for his lowest price ever. You can get a queen-size pillow for $29.98. It's normally $69.98. That's a $40 savings. Kings are only $5 more. Go to MyPillow.com and click on the radio listener's square and use promo code Dinesh. You'll also get deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Set. So call 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. So the impeachment train rolls on, and its destination, I think, is to block the Trump train. But is that the end of it? What are they after? Are they trying to just oust Trump? Are they trying to just disgrace him? Are they trying to prevent him from running again? Are they trying to lock him up? I gotta say, I feel really bad for this guy. He has been treated worse than just about anyone I can think of, certainly anyone in the mainstream of American politics. And what makes this even more tragic to me is here's a guy who was once celebrated, venerated, an icon of popular culture. So what changed? Well, really what changed is that Trump became a Republican. What changed is that Trump took on, if you will, the MAGA cause. What Trump did was he took on the establishment. And suddenly, this cultural hero became a villain. It's almost like, in a weird way, what happened to O.J., except O.J. actually committed a murder. So O.J. lost his reputation. But that's the analogy that jumps to my mind when I think of Trump. He literally went overnight from being the great guy to being public enemy number one as far as the left is concerned. And impeachment, ultimately, I think, is about driving a stake into Trump. And perhaps, this is something we'll discuss more, Trumpism. What is Trumpism? What's this Trumpism that they want to get rid of? What is their end game? Now, impeachment goes to the House tomorrow. The last time we had impeachment, the Republicans held together as a bunch. The Democrats got no Republican votes. I think this time they will get some Republican votes. How many is unclear. It looks like they've got confirmed just one, Adam Kinzinger, guy who has discovered the virtues of playing, you may say, to the liberal gallery. Suddenly, positive profiles of him begin to appear in all kinds of places, and he's clearly enjoying this attention. The question in the Senate, if it goes to the Senate, there's an issue of timing here. It may not really even get there, or certainly may not even get there before the Biden inauguration. But knowing who these people are, they don't really want to stop. Their talk of unity is hollow. What they really mean is they want us to unify. They want the whole country to unify against Trump. So the unity is based upon creating a villain and then mobilizing against that villain and what that villain represents. This impeachment, to me, is dumber even than the first one. So we've gone from stupid impeachment to stupider impeachment, or as my wife Debbie likes to say, el stupido, or estupido. I think that's the phrase. The first impeachment was about Trump making a phone call. A benign phone call. A phone call essentially saying, hey, have you guys thought of looking into this Biden corruption? And of course, the Democrats all screamed in unison, what corruption? There's nothing there. There's nothing even to look at. Why even raise the subject? This is treason. You're going after your political opponent. Well, what exactly were the Bidens doing in Ukraine? What was Hunter Biden up to? How did he get on the board of that company? Here's a short clip from the movie Trump Card that talks about this. Was there a Biden family racket in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. Go back to 2014. Barack Obama says, I want Joe Biden to be the point person for policy towards Ukraine, which means all aid dollars. Within 3 weeks of that appointment, a Ukrainian energy company called Burisma starts writing checks to the vice president's son. They were $83,333 a month, paid twice, because both Hunter Biden and his business partners are on the board of directors, and that amounts to $1 million each per year. These payments started in the spring of 2014 and continued for almost 5 years. And these 300-page documents show that's the amount that they were paid consistently every month.
Now, there was a Ukrainian prosecutor looking into all this. What happened to him?
We have a tape of Joe Biden bragging about how he gets Mr. Shokin fired.
We're not going to give you the $1 million. They said, you have no authority. You're not the president. The president said, I said, call him. I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, what, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a bitch. Got fired.
So that's just the tip of the iceberg, because this wasn't a Hunter Biden racket. It was a Joe Biden racket. This is, by the way, why the tech moguls all came together in the media not to cover this. It was really about Joe Biden, because Joe Biden had something to sell. Hunter Biden didn't. Neither did James Biden or Frank Biden, two of the Biden brothers. But all of these guys were bagmen for Joe. Traveling around the world, by the way, not just to Ukraine, they went to China, they made trips to Costa Rica, South America, they were collecting money left and right. This is, by the way, how the Bidens became multimillionaires, multiple homes, domestic staff. You can't afford this on a government salary. So the left wanted to suppress Trump from bringing this up, this corruption that is now so unseemly on the left. And these are people who claim to be coming to Washington to do good. Well, they might come to do good, but they stay to do very well for themselves. Let's turn to the second impeachment. This one, it's even dumber, because it's all based on this idea that Trump incited this insurgency, this attempted coup, this sort of forced occupation of the Capitol. And my question is, where's the videotape? If Trump incited them, it would have to have been at his speech at the rally. And why isn't CNN playing the clips?
Now it is up to Congress to confront this egregious assault on our democracy. And after this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down. Anyone you want, but I think right here, we're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country.
Why? Because Trump didn't say anything that comes close to meeting the definition of incitement. In fact, he said the exact opposite. He talked about people, quote, peacefully and patriotically marching on the Capitol. There's a deeper question here, and that is the question of timing. Trump was speaking, and the incursion on the Capitol, inexcusable, by the way, but nevertheless, began before Trump finished his speech. This is critical. This is critical because it means that Trump didn't incite them to do it. They planned to do it, or they were going to do it anyway. It was something that they pushed ahead with, and they were about it even before Trump had completed his remarks. Now, the scholar Jonathan Turley talks about what incitement means in a legal sense. It's kind of a legal term, so let's look at what it means. This is the Brandenburg versus Ohio case of 1969, which defines it very clearly. It is speech, quote, directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. So it isn't just that you say something, whatever, my name is Dinesh, and someone goes and storms the Capitol. So the speech has to be inciting the action. And second, it has to be likely to produce that result. Now, where is the proof that Trump did any of that? There is none. So what you have here, I think, is a show trial. It's a show trial that is intended to bring out, under the excuse of incitement, all this pent-up frustration and hatred of Trump that has been marinating for years, but has, in a sense, not found its outlet. And now, cruelly, viciously, and I would say in a fundamental way, undemocratically, I mean undemocratically here in the sense that this is a perversion of what the constitutional process of impeachment really means, it is finding its nasty outlet on the floors of Congress. We'll be right back. Some of the loudest, most strident voices calling for impeachment come, oddly enough, not from the Democrats. They come from the so-called Never Trumpers. And here I think of people like Ramesh Panuru of the National Review or Bill Kristol. So here's Ramesh with an article called Impeach, Convict, and Disqualify. Very imperious tone. And he sort of begins by saying, the question that should command congressional attention now is not whether Trump is guilty of criminal incitement in a way that would satisfy a court. And then he goes on to say that Trump's post-election campaign of conspiracy, theorizing, misinformation, and urging states to overturn their results satisfies Madison's definition of perfidy. This is Ramesh Panuru, graduate of Princeton. A guy who came to Washington, D.C. to make a big career. At one time, he actually said to me something like, I want to be the next Dinesh D'Souza, Asian Indian Ramesh. His name even rhymes with Dinesh. I think at one point, Ramesh was in a meeting with George W. Bush, and Bush called him Dinesh. I mean, this was crushing to his ego. But in any event, Ramesh hasn't done much since. He wrote a book on abortion called Party of Death that sunk like a stone. And many of these guys have been essentially academic failures and failures in their career. And Never Trumpism is a way for them to revive their careers. And this is why they talk such abject rubbish, because it's not rubbish, it's playing to an audience. Let me talk for a little bit about Bill Kristol. Here is a tweet. Bill Kristol is known for his sort of Solomonic tweets, and here's his latest one. He talks about, after the assault on the Capitol, I'm not quoting him, we're underestimating the threat of further violence, as if he knows. Republicans aren't rejecting Trumpism root and branch. Root and branch. What does he want to do, arrest all the 75 million people who voted for Trump? Root and branch. Conservatives aren't engaged in serious rethinking. Yes, but you are, Bill. Some Democrats lack a real sense of urgency. I am alarmed. So what he's basically saying is the Democrats are not being tough enough. They need to be more severe, more Robespierrean. What do you want, guillotines, Bill? So let's back up and look at these guys, because we need to get a good grip on who these people are. These are not conservatives who are loyal to Reagan and worried about the fact that conservatism has lost its way. None of that. There are people like that, but it's not these guys. I knew Bill Kristol pretty well. I've written for his magazine, The Weekly Standard, before The Weekly Standard, like Ramesh's book, Sunk Like a Stone. Bill Kristol's parents were Irving Kristol and Gertrude Himmelfarb, two great people, great scholars and wonderful human beings. Irving Kristol was genuinely one of my mentors, and I loved his ability to produce an aphorism. He's the one who came up with the idea that a neoconservative is a liberal who has been mugged by reality. Irving Kristol is also the author of the great line that Jews are the only people who earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. Now, that's no longer true, by the way. There are many people today who earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. But it was true in the 80s and 90s when Irving came up with that. And his wife, Bea Himmelfarb, wrote marvelous books about the Victorian era, the idea of poverty. For example, one of my favorites, Marriage and Morals Among the Victorians, a wonderful book about how America was even then forking into two cultures. And the fact that I can name these books even after the parents are dead tells me something. Bill Kristol may have written a book, but no one knows what it is, because he certainly hasn't written an important or influential book, nor has he really written important or influential articles. So we have an issue here. It's an issue not limited to politics. It's not limited to conservatism, of what happens when very talented parents produce a very untalented son. I mean, this is an historical problem. What would happen, for example, in the monarchies of Europe when a competent king had an incompetent heir? This is what Shakespeare's histories are all about. And even in our own time, there are competent people who have incompetent or useless children. The example that comes most quickly to mind is Reagan. Look at Ron Reagan. Years ago, I saw him at a radio station, and I'd never met the guy before. I went up to him, and just to be nice, I said, "Hey, I wrote a book about your dad, just talking about how an ordinary man became an extraordinary leader, the title of my book on Reagan." And he looked at me as if, "Why are you telling me this? Who cares?" In other words, his contempt, not for me, because he didn't know me, but his contempt for the legacy of his own father, just disgraceful. But this is Ron Reagan, and this really is Bill Kristol. So Bill Kristol comes to Washington, and what do you do when you don't have any talent, but you want to be worthy of your talented parents? Well, the answer is you have to pretend to something. You've got to sort of feign talent you don't have. And Bill Kristol became sort of the master of that. He became the master, I would say, of unflappability. Whenever you said something to him, however surprising, he pretended to be unsurprised. And so, for example, you talk about, you know, they're trying to impeach Reagan. Oh, yeah, well, of course, you know, I saw that coming. That's Bill. If you went to Bill and said, you know, 9/11, oh, yeah, of course, you know, the Muslims, they've been doing this since the 7th century. So this is Bill. He doesn't know what's coming, but when it comes, he sort of pretends like he was there all along on this subject. Hey, Bill, World War III is starting. Oh, yeah, of course, you know, I saw it coming. You know, it's bound to happen. So this is really Bill Kristol. And once people on the right figured this out, they began to realize this guy has nothing to offer except this pseudo-sophistication. But Bill is a little bit like Commodus in the movie The Gladiator. He doesn't have wisdom, he doesn't have virtue, but what he does have is a certain kind of low cunning. And he figured out that although he's useless on the right, he's useful to the left. Why? Because what if a conservative, or at least a careerist pretending to be a conservative, what if that kind of guy sells his services to the left? What if Bill Kristol goes to people like George Soros and goes, listen, it's one thing if the left bashes Republicans, but what if I, who have been on the Republican side for a long, what if I do it? What's that worth to you? I think this is the key to understanding the never-Trumper phenomenon. These are Steve Schmidt, all these characters. None of them were really that important on the right, but they have found extremely profitable niches on the left, and they have to keep themselves useful by being, in a sense, more Robespierrean than Robespierre himself. Why? Because at the end of the day, once the left gets rid of Trump and once they get rid of the Trumpsters, the automatic next step will be to get rid of these losers. We'll be right back. I want to talk to you about MyPillow, this amazing pillow that is going to make you sleep like you've never slept before. These pillows are fantastic. They won't go flat. You can wash and dry them anytime you want. They're all made in the USA. Now, normally these pillows, $69.98, but you can get a queen size premium MyPillow for $29.98. That's $40 off. King size pillows are only $5 more. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener's square, and use promo code Dinesh. You can also get deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Sets. Or call 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. Now, I've been thinking about the loss of life in D.C., and I've been thinking particularly about the poor woman, Ashley Babbitt, who was shot in the neck. The shooting seems really inexcusable because she was unarmed. She wasn't threatening the police. She was pushing her way through a door that, by the way, she didn't break the glass, someone else did, but she was the first one apparently trying to get in. I certainly agree that it was reckless of her to do this. And I think as a veteran, she should have known that the Capitol is heavily guarded. This is something that you should not do. But just because she was reckless doesn't mean that she deserved to be shot. And so this is a very sad episode. And it's kind of interesting how the left is almost taking a relish in this, showing certainly no regret over this loss of life. No sense that this perhaps could have been avoided. And the sickening contrast with the way that the left took all these characters, people with long criminal rap sheets and, you know, Blake and George Floyd, and they had all these funerals and gold caskets. I mean, now, I saw a very poignant video in which a young woman who had been maced during this Capitol Hill incursion. This young woman was flustered afterward, and she was talking about the experience, and she goes, "I'm so distraught." And someone asked her, they said, "Well, why did you do it? What were you thinking?" And she goes, I thought it was 1776. And that phrase struck me because I think that is that tells you that you got people who think that they were doing revolution. This term, it's 1776, was all over social media. But I think it reflects a little moral unseriousness because it reflects, in a sense, no understanding of what 1776 was all about. 1776 was about a military general, George Washington, who had a lot of military experience. He had been an officer for the British against the French in the Ohio Valley. His party had been ambushed. He had crossed freezing rivers. He had been an aide to General Braddock to expel the French from the Ohio Valley. And the American militias were fighting a ragtag war against the British, but it was a ragtag war with a very kind of deep insight behind it. And the deep insight was that the British are not fighting on their home ground. We Americans are. So the British are not going to fight us, the Americans, the way they fought Napoleon. To us, it's going to be a nuisance. Is it really worth it? And so even a force that is inferior to the British can defeat the British the same way that the Vietnamese defeated America two centuries later. The Vietnamese won not because America couldn't beat them, but it wasn't ultimately worth it for us to expend so many lives and treasure to do it. We decided it's better to get out. And the British exited America for the same reason. But Washington had to fight. He had faced mutiny from his own soldiers. He faced very difficult massacres. The French had great victories in New York. They occupied Philadelphia, the home of the Continental Congress. And it was only in 1781 that the battle turned, when Washington helped crucially with reinforcements from the French, was able to defeat a British force. By the way, a numerically inferior British force at that point. And the British Parliament, which was always divided about the war, ultimately decided, that's it, we're out of here. That was 1776. That was a war. It took 5 years. It took guerrilla warfare and military strategy. So there's something a little bit unserious in people thinking, I can waltz into the Capitol. I'm a 21st century revolutionary. Revolutions are not for fun. A revolution is a very serious matter, and I think in some ways it does injustice to the American Revolution to irresponsibly invoke it for an expedition that is nothing more than playing at revolution. We'll be right back.
Honey, I cannot believe you said that.
It's super funny. And it's not... I want to address the situation as it is developing at Parler, a very important platform, a real alternative to Twitter, a platform that was growing very fast. In fact, it was the number one, the fastest growing app. And precisely for that reason, not for its failure, but because of its success, you had three tech giants, Google, Apple, and Amazon, gang up, you may say collude, in a coordinated attack on Parler of a kind that I think we have never seen on a company. The attack was entirely ideological because while the pretext is Parler encourages violence, the kind of violence that led to the takeover of the Capitol, first of all, no case was ever made that this assault on the Capitol, this Capitol takeover, was plotted on Parler. No one's even alleged that. Essentially, Amazon supplied Parler with, here are some incendiary statements made on Parler. By the way, you could find 10 times as many incendiary statements from the left on Twitter. Nothing happens. In fact, Jack Dorsey of Twitter gave millions of dollars to Colin Kaepernick after Kaepernick himself made incendiary statements, which were shortly after that succeeded by all kinds of violence by BLM, Antifa, and other groups sort of taking up this cause and, you may say, going to town with it. So Parler has been knocked off its pedestal. It's gone dark. You can't get it on the Apple podcast anymore. And even if you have it, as I do, I love Parler. And I've been growing exponentially on Parler. I had been. And so, for example, over a long period of time, I had reached 1.9 million followers on Twitter. By the way, that's dropped to 1.7 million. I don't know if this is a Twitter purge or if people are just so disgusted with Twitter, they're just walking away. But while I was losing ground on Twitter, I was gaining so fast on Parler that I was at 2.6 million. My Parler platform in a few months was bigger than my Twitter, which I'd built over a year. So Parler was a big deal. It is a big deal. And I know it's a big deal because I was talking to some Wall Street money guys, and they were saying, you know, what's this thing about Parler? We keep hearing about Parler. And that means that from a financial point of view, leaving ideology aside, the money men of Washington, of New York, were thinking about Parler as a rising stock, as something that had a lot of promise, looking at it purely from a financial point of view. And so this is why the attack. The attack is partly motivated, I think, economically to block Parler, to create room for Twitter, but also second, to shut down alternative voices. Now, again, for a while there were some libertarians who said things like, well, Dinesh, stop complaining about censorship on Twitter, on Facebook. It's their platform. They can do whatever they want. Go create your own platform. And so the people at Parler did. And what happened? There's a coordinated attack, an attack that seems to involve state and private entities because it's being approved and cheered by people in Congress, by Biden people, people on the left, against Parler. So Parler has filed a massive lawsuit against Amazon. And I hope that this is crushing because it's not going to be that hard to show that this was a coordinated attack. It's not going to be hard to show the whopping double standards that have driven this. Amazon basically gave Parler 24 hours to produce a plan to block all objectionable content from its site. Just a preposterous resolution, so-called resolution, impossible for anyone to meet. I just saw today that Parler has found a new hosting service. I hope that's true. Epic. A service that is not going to be intimidated as some others were. If Amazon drops you, we're not sure we can take you. Well, I hope that there's a group of you. I was thinking, you know what? I'm going to try to talk to some people in India. Why? Because there are lots of Indians who love America. There are lots of Indians who love Trump. And there are lots of Indians who are smarter than the Yahoos who work at some of these tech companies. And so if you don't want to do it here, and if the left is powerful enough to block every American company from doing it, hey, let's get some Indians in India to do it. But maybe Parler has found a solution. I certainly hope so. I think what worries me here, and Parler is kind of the opening door to this, is the left's attempt to sort of try to use all the weapons of technology. So you can't go to Parler and post there. And then you can't do e-banking. And then you can't pay through PayPal. And so to sort of shut down the technology highway and deprive millions of Americans of the use of it, the ability to not only express themselves in terms of free speech, but even navigate in terms of their ordinary lives, paying for stuff, shopping, being able to navigate sites and learn things. They're trying to block that too. So this is a very ominous development. And I think what it tells us, and this is the question I was raising at the beginning of the podcast, what is their end game? Their end game appears to be not just to go after Trump, not just perhaps to jail Trump, but to end Trumpism. And in my closing segment, I'll try to explore what that might mean. We'll be right back. I'm Dinesh D'Souza, and this is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, follow me on social media. I'm at Dinesh D'Souza on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. Also subscribe to my channel at Rumble. And also subscribe on the Apple Podcast. And please leave me a 5-star review if you like what you hear. Now, I want to talk about where this is going. What is the left's end game? And I think for that, a very instructive guide in helping us think through all this is the English writer George Orwell. My wife, Debbie, has an article about Orwell, it's called Big Tech Brother is Watching. The reference, of course, is to Orwell's Big Brother. And there's an analogy here between Big Brother and Big Tech. Big Tech is, in a sense, playing the role of Big Brother. This is, by the way, on the website called lamerican.com. Terrific article, so take a look. But what I'm getting at here is Orwell is creeping back in a big way into our discourse. And this, of course, raises questions like, what do we mean by Big Brother? What did Orwell mean? In what sense was it true as Orwell projected it? And how is it true today? I want to begin on this podcast to kind of look at Orwell. And I'm doing it in part because I'm seeing these kind of sarcastic jibes on social media. Well, here's one from Jake Tapper. It's very Jake Tapperian. It's almost as if none of these folks have actually read one word of Orwell. Jake Tapper. Now, first of all, I can pretty much bet that Jake Tapper's reading of Orwell is what he read in high school. And I'm sure that when Tapper thinks of Orwell today, he thinks, oh, I'm Winston. I'm the one being persecuted by Trump. Trump is Big Brother. Trump's the dictator. This would be the kind of reasoning you'd expect from Tapper. Of course, you could then probe that by saying, really, Jake, has Trump taken you off the air? Has Trump put you in the torture chamber, room 101? Remember that one? Has Trump found out the things you hate like rats and put rats on your face? No, none of that, really. In fact, you've been free for the last 4 years to bash Trump without respite. Does that sound very dictatorial to you? So I actually tweeted out to Jake. I go, hey, Jake, listen, I took a course on Orwell at our mutual alma mater, Dartmouth. I've read every book of Orwell's, not just, of course, 1984, but all the earlier ones. Orwell is a very interesting figure. In his early books, Down and Out in Paris and London, which just a very vivid picture of poverty in the British sort of underclass, as we call it now, Orwell himself worked menial job. So he knew what he was talking about. He has a great scene in Down and Out in Paris and London where he's walking outside a store window and he looks in and he goes, I saw this homeless guy. And he goes, and I realized with some shock that it was me. Orwell had become so dirty, so disheveled that he didn't recognize himself in the window. Later, Orwell wrote a book called Keep the Aspidistra Flying. The aspidistra here refers to a plant in a window. It's a symbol for sort of lower middle class values. And Orwell's point is that these lower middle class values, although they may seem corny, old-fashioned, simple, things like tell the truth, be reliable, keep your word, these are what keeps society together. These are what makes civilization go on the ground level, the bread and butter, you might say, of civilization. And then homage to Catalonia, where Orwell fought on the rebel side of the Spanish Civil War against Franco's generals, a great work. Orwell's essay on politics and language, well worth reading, and we'll probably read it at some point in this podcast. Of course, Animal Farm, and then 1984. So I'd like to begin close readings of Orwell that I'm going to continue over several podcasts, but I'll begin here with just a little tidbit and leave you with that for this one. This is a scene out of the movie Trump Card, and it is a riveting recreation of a scene from 1984. Watch.
Look, I've confessed. I'm a religious believer. Admirer of capitalism.
A sexual pervert? What more do you want?
Don't worry, Winston. You're in my keeping. For 7 years, I've
watched over you. Now the turning point has come. I shall save you.
I shall make you perfect.
Who did that filming? My God, that is good stuff. That guy really knows how to make movies, I gotta tell ya. Well, the scene is it's the climax of Orwell. Winston, the protagonist, the guy who has been a rebel against the deep state, against Big Brother. And Big Brother here is this amorphous entity. Nobody knows who it is. I think Orwell didn't even want to pin it down. He implies that it is, in some sense, the state. But he doesn't say if it is the state working with any outside entities. At one point, he refers to the inner party and the outer party. Kind of a useful way to think. You can think of the left in America today as having an inner party, and that is the people in the police agencies of government. And then there's an outer party, which would include people like the media, people who don't seem like they're part of any kind of a party, who seem really clueless on the outside. People like Jim Acosta, sort of overgrown fetus, like, oh, am I a member of a party? No, not really. But he is. Why? Because he marches in lockstep. He's part of the team. He knows it deep down. He plays by the rules. And he tries to profit by those rules. And in this scene, this is the breaking point for Winston, because his interrogator asks him, don't you remember writing in your diary that 2 + 2 = 4, that freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4? And Winston goes, yes. Essentially, Winston had written something to the effect that, look, you can take my freedom, you can lock me up, you can separate me from my family, you can deprive me of food and water, but I will cling to the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. In other words, I will cling to reality. It remains what it is. It can't be changed. At least that one thing is firm. And O'Brien, the interrogator, basically says, well, what if we say it's 5? He's trying to get Winston to admit that 2 plus 2 is 5. And Winston won't do it. He refuses. And so what do? They torture him. Sensory deprivation. They lock him up. As I mentioned earlier, he's terrified of rats. And they talk about how there are always secret terrors that prey on our mind. There's a certain wall we create around ourselves. This is the genius of Orwell's writing. We create a wall around ourselves emotionally to protect us from, you can call it almost primordial fears. And in Winston's case, that's it. It's rats eating his eyes and biting his neck. And so that's what they do to him. They bring in the rats, so to speak. And Winston is so terrified, he breaks down completely. And he goes, okay, 2 plus 2 is 5. I admit it. Can I go now? And of course, the chilling answer is no, Winston, you can't go. Why? Because we're not satisfied. You're only saying that 2 plus 2 is 5 because you know that's what we want to hear. You just want the pain to stop. You just want us to pull back on the rats. We demand not merely outward conformity, but inner submission. In other words, we want to destroy your will. We want to destroy your individuality. We want to make you into a worm. We want you to grovel. So this is where Orwell is going. What Orwell is saying is that totalitarian socialism, and Orwell is talking about socialism. It's ironic because Orwell is a man of the left. But Orwell is saying, nevertheless, that socialism is not content with economic confiscation. It's not content with censorship. In the end, it wants to destroy all opposition, and it wants to destroy the idea of the individual himself. Why? Because as long as there is an inner fortress, an inner mind that can resist this, think of the great line from Milton's Paradise Lost, a line uttered actually by Satan, who conquers by force, hath conquered only half his foe, which means that the inner mind is unconquered. The inner will remains rebellious and free. And for the left and for Orwell, totalitarianism means breaking that last frontier. Is this where the left wants to take us? They deny that they're being Orwellian. Poor Jake Tapper thinks he's Winston, being persecuted in some way. But in reality, it is what the left has been trying for a while. And finally now, they feel like they've got the cultural control, the corporate control, the political control to take their most malevolent wishes and turn them into reality. We're not going to let them. But how? How do we fight them? How do we stop them? These are going to be topics I'm going to be taking up in subsequent podcasts. But for now, thanks for listening. Please follow me on social media, at Dinesh D'Souza on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. And also on subscribe to my channel on Rumble. And go to Apple and like my podcast and rate it. I hope you'll give me a 5-star rating. I hope you'll keep watching. I'll be right back. I really enjoyed meeting Mike Lindell, the founder of MyPillow. He's a remarkable guy. When he first met me and Debbie, we sat down across from each other at a restaurant, and he spoke for 30 minutes straight. He was a fire hose of anecdotes and information, and the two of us literally just sat there in amazement, and we were at the end of it, we were like, wow. Mike, of course, was telling us everything he wanted us to know. That's just how he is. He's exuberant. But it's this exuberance and creativity that has produced a great product, MyPillow. And it's a pillow that won't go flat. You can wash it anytime. It's made in the USA. It's really comfortable. Mike's the kind of guy who doesn't want you to endorse his product if you haven't tried it. And my wife, Debbie, who's been having trouble sleeping, she's in that period of her life, and she said, okay, well, let me try MyPillow. And then she's been saying day after day, she goes, this pillow is downright amazing. She actually calls him Magic Mike, which perhaps is, given the movie Magic Mike, not the perfect reference. But what she means is this is a magical pillow. And you can get it queen size for $29.98. It's regularly $69.98. That's $40 off. It's only $5 more for a king size pillow. So just go to mypillow.com, click on Radio Listener Square, and use the promo code Dinesh. You can also get discounts on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, and MyPillow towel sets. Or call 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh.